We're talking about C.S. Lewis today, and usually when you have talks about C.S. Lewis, they are about his thought, and we may touch on his thought, but we're going to especially just look at his life. So C.S. Lewis, the C is Clive and the S is Staples. He was born in 1898 in Ireland, and I wouldn't call the family dysfunctional, but there were some challenges in the family. The daddy they called him a solicitor, which we would say an attorney, and had some communication issues. You know, everybody has issues, and he had his. Lewis had an older brother named Warren that he called Warney. C.S. Lewis called Warney a lot, and the brother, they were tight. They were tight siblings, and there are copies of notes. Here we go. They're getting them to you. And so anyway, they were tight and enjoyed some early years together before Warney went off to school. When C.S. Lewis was baptized as just a little baby into the Church of Ireland by his grandfather was a minister, and that's interesting, that part in his life. When Lewis was 5 years old, he went to his family and he said, "You can now call me Jaxie. You can now call me Jaxie." And nobody knows exactly why that happened. There's some talk of maybe there was a dog or something, but then it was shortened to Jax, and then it was shortened to Jack. And one of the biographies that I will recommend to you before we are through is titled Jack. And so his friends called him Jack. That's who he was. They lived in Ireland for a while. When Lewis read books all over the place, the family had lots of books. His mother was something of a scholar. She had gone to university, which was significant. She was really good in math, which Lewis was not. She did not pass that along to him. He nearly didn't get into college because of an inability to pass math tests. I could relate to that here. But anyway, the books all over the place. In one of the houses where they lived, they had all these little crawl spaces. If you've read the Chronicles of Narnia and some of the stuff associated with that, some of that ties in with home experiences that he had. But he just read and read and read. So in your notes, halfway down that page one, it says that he had read Paradise Lost by age 10. I surely hadn't. And I get a feeling maybe he understood it at age 10, but he just read and read. His mother died in 1908, so he's born in 1898, so he's about 10 years old. And the death of his mother was traumatic in his life. It was traumatic for him spiritually, not just the idea of losing your mom, but spiritually it was pretty tough. He prayed, you know, when his mama was dying, he prayed that she wouldn't die. And when she died, he drew some conclusions about the efficacy of prayer and about God. Which is not hard to understand how that might transpire. And so we've got a quotation here about his mama, Flora. She dies, and then Lewis wrote, "With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life." Disappeared from my life. And Jack's daddy wrote of her, "As good a woman, wife, and mother as God has ever given to man." So she was a fine lady, and all of a sudden absent. And that left poor Albert, Jack's daddy, with what do I do with these boys? And so what happened was they were off to boarding school. England does lots of boarding schools. You know, I'm from middle class kind of stuff, you know, average kind of guy here. And I just kind of went to the public elementary school and the public junior high and high school and so forth. But there may be places in America to where boarding school is kind of regular stuff. But anyway, in England, it definitely was regular stuff. Lots of folks would send their children off to school and they would live there. You know, they would come home every now and then. And there were some great benefits to that educationally in some instances, and in some instances, some real troubles too. Lots of those places, boys' schools, you know, and there was a lot of homosexuality, which Lewis saw had to deal with some of that. So he's off to school, and some of those early school experiences were not good. So you'll see halfway down the page again, page one, from 1908, again, that's about age 10, to 1914. He's in these different schools. The first one he went to was in Wynyard, and he called it, he nicknamed it Belsen, after a German concentration camp, which tells you something of his attitude about that. There were 9 boarders that attended, and then some day students, I guess local folks that were able to just kind of come to school along with him. The headmaster there was a preacher named Robert Capron. He was about 60, and Warren wrote about him. He was the most complete domestic tyrant I have ever met with or ever read of. And the school closed shortly after Jack was there for a little while, with the headmaster being declared insane. So this was a pretty tough educational experience for him. Then he went to Sherburg School in Great Malvern near Birmingham, England, for about 2.5 years. And while he was there, he became pretty much a confirmed atheist. He smoked the rest of his life. He smoked cigarettes, he smoked pipe. And some of the pictures that you'll see of him indicate that. By the way, there's pictures at the very back, so about 3 pages back. You can see some of those. Forgive me, I'm technologically challenged, and so, you know, they are what they are. But that top one, you can see Lewis as a youngster there, bike riding with his brother. And then you can see Lewis and his daddy, Albert, there in picture number 2, and we'll look at some more of that as we go along. So he goes, after that experience, he goes to what's called Malvern College. They call colleges over there in England. I don't know all the ins and outs of this, but I've just bumped into it enough to know. They'll say college, and I think college, and it's high school, is what it amounts to. And so he goes to Malvern College, a boarding school, for another year. And he was not athletic, which these schools had a lot of athletic stuff going on with them. He did not do well. He was in the bottom half of his class. one biographer, it says he showed little sign of great academic ability in Greek and Latin. And he wrote to his daddy and said, please get me out of here, in essence. Please take me out as soon as possible. And then he added in there that I think I'm going to shoot myself if you don't. And I think that maybe accomplished the task. So then he was given to a private tutor that had some experience with the family, his older brother in particular. And this guy's name was William Thompson Kirkpatrick. And this was in Great Bookham in southern England. And Lewis liked nicknames. I mean, his brother, he called him Big Piggy Bottom. And Lewis himself, Jack, was Little Piggy Bottom. And the daddy was Potatum, I think it was. Potatum or something like that. And so this Kirkpatrick became the Great Knock. The teacher was called. You don't look that innocent. You've probably had names for your teachers, too. But he called him the Great Knock. He was a lapsed Irish Presbyterian, and he was quite a scholar. And this is private tutelage. Isn't that interesting? What a way to do school. It's kind of like one teacher, he teaches you everything, one student, you know, here you go. They didn't always just have one, but this guy was a reasoning machine. That's just what he did. He just kind of thought, if you kind of said the weather is wonderful, he would go, so what is wonderful? You know, and you just kind of have to wrestle through everything that you would have to say. And Lewis soaked that up, man. I mean, he got right into the heart of that. And there's correspondence that has survived between this teacher, the Great Knock, and Lewis's daddy, Albert. On the top of page 2, I think it's on the top of your page 2, there's a quotation here where it says, I do not think there can be much doubt as to the genuine and lasting quality of Clive's individual abilities. It is the maturity and originality of his literary judgments, which is so unusual and surprising. Clive has ideas of his own and is not at all the sort of boy to be made a mere receptive machine. Some teachers sometimes think that how you educate is you pop the lid on the head and you pour the stuff in. And what he's saying is Lewis was not that kind of a guy. You could give him information, but he's going to sift through it all and put his own twist on it. And he was very interesting in that regard. He was confirmed as a Christian in December of 1914 at St. Mark's in Dundella, after having been baptized again as an infant. But he was an atheist, and he didn't have the heart to tell his daddy. And so he just kind of went through with the ceremony. In October 1916, he wrote to his friend Arthur Greaves. They were pretty tight as youngsters. Lewis wrote, I believe in no religion. There is absolutely no proof for any of them, and from a philosophical standpoint, Christianity is not even the best. All religions, that is, all mythologies, to give them their proper name, are merely man's own invention. What interesting reading to kind of get his take on stuff before and after conversion. In his late teens, he had some sadomasochistic tendencies, and I've read a little bit about that, not a whole lot, but just kind of some weird stuff. He had seen some cruelty in school. There had been some teachers who had been pretty hard on the kids. And then kids were being hard on kids, and he saw that, and writers basically just kind of struggle with what in the world, you know, led him down this road. May have been some things that he read as well, but the idea of just some cruelty and some sexual aspect to that as well. He is wanting to go. His father, no doubt, is wanting him to go to one of the big schools, and so he sits for exams at New College. Oxford University's got all these different colleges. And so he sits for exams at New College, and he didn't make it. They did not accept him, but he did well. And he was brought to the attention of another school, University College, and so they said, yeah, we would like to have you. And so he was able to go to school. But World War I was kicking in, and so he was forced to join up. And so when you read his biographies, which I'll make some recommendations here before we're through, Lord willing, you will read some sections about his experience in the war. He had a roommate that he called Paddy Moore, and they made a pact between themselves that if either one of them was killed, then that the other would take care of the parent that was left. And it so happened that happened. So you can see photo 3 there at the back that shows Paddy and Jack together. And so this young Jack Lewis, isn't it interesting to think about how God providentially has some people die in war and some people live, and he had Jack Lewis live, and it changed the world that way. So when Lewis was 19 years old, he's in the trenches in northwestern France, and there's a shell that explodes. I've read different accounts. One said it was friendly fire, one said it was a German shell. It exploded near Lewis, really near, killed the fellow standing right beside him. He was injured himself, relatively minor wounds, but wounds that required his hospitalization, and he had some shrapnel in his body the rest of his life. Later he wrote, so we'll just skip ahead just for a moment just to kind of pick up this little piece of correspondence. He writes to his friend Bede Griffiths about war, because now World War, this is 1939, another war is looming. And he says, my memories of the last war haunted my dreams for years. Military service, to be plain, includes the threat of every temporal evil. Pain and death, which is what we fear from sickness. Isolation from those we love, which is what we fear from exile. You can see his analysis already working here. Toil under arbitrary masters, injustices and humiliation, which is what we fear from slavery. Hunger, thirst, cold, and exposure, which is what we fear from poverty. I'm not a pacifist. If it's got to be, it's got to be. But the flesh is weak and selfish, and I think death would be much better than to live through another war. This war, you know, experiences shape us, and this one really shaped him. And he struggled with it, and again had nightmares for some period of time. During his convalescence, Lewis's convalescence, his friend Arthur Greaves writes him and tells that he is a homosexual, and Lewis jokingly celebrated that fact. So he's hurt, he's recovered, his life's not in jeopardy, but he's hurt, he's in the hospital, he's young, you know, wartime, and so he corresponds with his daddy. Mom is dead, you know, so he's corresponding with his daddy. He says, Daddy, come visit. Daddy, come visit. Writes repeatedly, gives messages to his daddy to come. And his daddy never comes. His daddy went to work. He used some excuses for not coming, but his daddy never came. You see one little note here where it says, he wrote to his daddy, it is 4 months now since I returned from France, and my friends laughingly suggest that my father in Ireland, of whom they hear, is a mythical creation. And again, Albert never went to visit him. So Paddy Moore, his roommate, is killed, and Lewis tries to take up on what he's supposed to do from the pact that they had made. So Mrs. Jane King Moore, his 46-year-old mother. So there, think about the ages here now. She's 46. She's separated from her husband. She moves to where C.S. Lewis was recovering. And the family learns, Lewis's family learns about this, and it's just a twist in their brain. What in the world, you know, is going on here? Warren Lewis, so Lewis's brother, wrote to his father May the 10th, 1919, about his brother and Mrs. Moore. "It seems to me preposterous that there can be anything in it, but the whole thing irritates me by its freakishness." It's the age disparity there, and I think just their knowledge of who he was. Albert replied to that letter, Lewis's daddy, "It worries and depresses me greatly. All I know is that she is old enough to be his mother," which, by the way, psychologically, you know, may have something to play in all of this. Opinions vary about the relationship of Lewis and Mrs. Moore as to whether it was platonic or whether it was sexual. And scholars that are writing to this day and discussing it still don't come down on saying this is what it is. Nobody knows. Everybody speculates. So they live, there's never anything explicit about a sexual relationship between the two, but Mrs. Moore destroyed the letters that they had passed between one another later in her life. They lived in the same house. They didn't live in the same bedroom, we know that, but the bedrooms were adjoining. And George Sayer, one of the biographers of Lewis, when he wrote the book and the copy that I read, said he was pretty highly confident that there was not a sexual relationship between the two. But then after that book was over, then he talked to Mrs. Moore's daughter, Maureen, and after that conversation he said, "I think I was wrong. I think there was a sexual relationship between the two." One of Lewis's good friends, Owen Barfield, in the 1920s, he said it was a 50-50 guess as to whether or not that relationship what it was. George Sayer, again from the book that I just alluded to, said it seems very odd if they were lovers that he would call her mother, which he did call her mother. So there's this unusual thing. He did keep it a secret from his family, especially from his daddy, of some of the ins and outs of the relationship there. The war ended. He goes back to Oxford University to study classical languages, and I list his daily routine there. And so I'm just going to skip over that. You can look at that as you choose to. And if I can hurry through, then we'll open the floor for questions, and I may not know the answers, but we can just discuss as we discuss. You're probably in here because you know about him, maybe more than I know about him, but I enjoy learning about him. So in university, they had waiters, basically. They call them scouts, who would bring you tea in the morning, wake you up, you know, make your bed, do different things for you. That was really helpful, so he had that. But he also had Mrs. Moore living nearby, and so he would spend time there in university, and then he would go out to Mrs. Moore's house. Again, the daddy, Albert, was kind of kept in the dark about a lot of this. He knew enough to be concerned. Albert recorded that his son deceived me and said, because they wound up having some disputes about this, Albert was paying the bills. And some of the money that he was making available was going to help this lady support her. She's a woman without a husband. And so when some of this stuff kind of hits the fan, they have some real trouble. "He deceived me," Albert said, "and said terrible, insulting, and despising things to me." Albert said it was one of the most miserable periods of my life. And so this was a tough thing. Lewis did really well in school. They would categorize students in groups. For the longest, when I heard that he had three firsts in university, I thought that means he was top in his class in one subject and top in his class in another subject and so forth. And that's not the case. When you read that, they'll put them in groups, and if you're in the top group, you're in the first class. And so he was in three top groups. Still, that's very significant. These are high-level schools, and he was a smart guy, did really well. He developed a friendship. I'm on the middle of page three. He developed a friendship with Owen Barfield, an Oxford scholar. He winds up receiving a fellowship, which is not a professorship, but it's akin to it. You do some teaching anyway, in English language and literature at Magdalen. They say that Magdalen. I say Magdalen, but I understand they tend to say Magdalen College in Oxford in October. And the president had him kneel down, as they would have students do, and recited a lot of Latin things. I think Lewis wrote and said that he picked up about 25%, he could understand about 25% of what the fellow was saying over him, but he wrapped it up by saying, "I wish you joy." So his physical appearance, I've noted that here. Interesting guy to look at. One student said he was a big man with a large red face and shabby clothes. Everybody would talk about, you'd read about C.S. Lewis and you picture, you know, in your brain who this is. And from his writing, you know, I think you kind of picture somebody that's up erect and straight and polished and all that stuff. And they would meet him, and that's just not the way that it was, especially his attire. Maybe he needed a wife to help him with that. A big man with a large, shabby clothes, looking like nothing so much as a prosperous butcher, who began addressing his audience in a loud, booming voice and with tremendous gusto. Lewis was a big worker. He worked and worked and worked. His brother said, Jack was one of those rare and fortunate people whose idea of recreation overlaps and even coincides with their necessary work. So books, that was his job. His job was books. He's supposed to just kind of like know all about English literature and lots of other stuff too. And that's what he wanted to do, you know, it's throw me in the briar patch kind of thing. His lectures were well attended. Look at this quotation from his lectures. Wouldn't you love to go back and listen to C.S. Lewis lecture? He lectured for precisely 3/4 of an hour, and he never waited to answer questions. 2 minutes before the end of the lecture, he would quietly gather his notes together, return the watch, which at one time he was in the habit of borrowing from the nearest member of his audience, and he would prepare to leave lecturing all the time. Then as he finished his last sentence, he would step off the dais and stride down the hall at top speed. It was as if he was at all late in arriving at the lecture, he would begin it even before he entered the hall. Several times the great voice came booming up the steps outside the hall door, and Lewis would enter in haste, lecturing vigorously. Kind of from the get-go, boy, he would go after it. Language, man, he was into language. What the great Nock did in training him, by the way, is he would say, okay, go and try, like in Latin or Greek, go and translate the first 40 lines of Euclid. And so he would go and work on it, and then he would say, all right, come down and translate for me. And so he would translate it, and they would go over it, and then he would say, all right, go and do the next lines. And they would kind of go back over the old stuff and over the new stuff, and Lewis just soaked that up and did really well. He was fluent in Norse, Old and Middle English. He really was a professor of medieval English literature, was his area of expertise. You know, it's hard to get that from everything that you read, at least the stuff that I've read by him, but that's area of expertise. If you get into his high-level writings, that's a lot of what he wrote. Fluent in Latin, Greek, French, German, Italian. Prodigious memory. You know, they say that he could just quote a line from Paradise Lost, and he could tell you what the next line was over and over again. William Empson said of him, he was the best-read man in his generation, one who read everything and remembered everything that he read. I read a lot. I hope not too much, but I read a lot. But he read a whole lot more, and he remembered what he read. My mind's a sieve. He especially liked reading old literature. You know, he read new stuff too. He read new too, but he especially liked old. I think he said, you know, for everyone new, read too old, something like that. He wrote about chronological snobbery, which I think we still have today, and maybe it's a forever sort of thing. You know, whatever is newer is better than the old stuff. And the old stuff, you know, if you can get hands on old stuff, lots of times the reason you can get your hands on it is because it stood the test of time. And so he kind of knew that, and so he wrote about that. And he liked to have the clean sea breeze of the centuries blowing through our minds, he said. So he is this, he has a fellowship there at Magdalen, and so they give him a bedroom and sitting rooms. There are pictures of that, not here in my stuff, but it was a lovely place for him to stay. And here's another schedule. Woken up at 7:15, chapel at 8, 8:15 breakfast with some others. 9 o'clock tutorials begin. We'll talk about those here in a moment. They would continue until 1 p.m. Then he would go home to where Mrs. Moore was, work in the garden. He loved to walk tons. Sometimes he would walk with a book in his hand and read while he walked, spend some time with family. And again, we're not sure about all that. But anyway, 4:45, back to college, tutorials commence. That goes till 7 and then dinner. And he would spend his evenings regularly reading. He got together with friends a lot. And we'll talk again about that also. And when his friends would get together, I mean, sometimes they would just talk it up. This guy, Lewis, loved friends. I mean, he really valued friendship, invested himself in that. And so his evenings weren't all solitary. I mean, sometimes he would be by his lonesome, but a lot of times he would be with friends. But lots of times when he was with his friends, they would be reading books, and they would read back and forth. I say this for my wife to hear so that she will want me to do that with her at night. So when I say, honey, listen to this. So what was the tutorial like that he gave? Middle of page 4, the tutorial always began the same way. The pupil would read the essay that he had been told to write the week before. Jack, who would have spent some time that week reading the same books that the student had read related to the essay, would sit listening, very often lighting, smoking, and relighting his pipe, perhaps making a few notes. Afterwards, he would make wide-ranging criticisms, some of them semantic, related to word meanings or philological, and he always, because he always hated the inexact use of words. He was an English guy, after all. He became friends with J.R.R. Tolkien of Hobbit and Lord of the Rings fame. They were good buds. You'll find pictures of the two together. He called him Tollers. Lewis called Tolkien Tollers. September 25, 1929, Albert Lewis died of complications from cancer. And, you know, this is just real trouble for Lewis. I mean, I think a lot of the trouble was because their relationship had just been bad and there was guilt that was associated. You can see that here. Alistair McGrath, one of Lewis's biographers, wrote, "Lewis unquestionably felt both pain and guilt at his father's death for much of the remainder of his life. There are hints of this at numerous points in his letters, especially in the dramatic opening sentence of a letter of March 1954. I treated my own father abominably, and no sin in my whole life now seems to be so serious." You know, I'm a preacher. When God says honor your father and your mother, it's not just a command, it fits with our nature. And when we violate our nature, it causes dysfunction and problems and guilt. And that's what he's experiencing. In February 1940, in a letter to his brother, he referred to, quote, "my many sins against the potato bird," that's a nickname for his daddy, "the blackest chapter in my life." Lewis and his brother, adult brother now, of course, for adulthood, and Mrs. Moore bought property called the Kilns. I have a picture of that there in the back, photograph number 5. They moved there in 1930. And you can look at photo 6-2 to see an adult picture of Jack's brother, Warney, there. So Mrs. Moore is the lady of the house. Again, they're not. You know, this is not a marriage, but she's the lady of the house. And Warney called life with Mrs. Moore an autocracy and a stifling tyranny. So it was some difficulties there. She had lots of to-do lists that Jack caught most of, and there were struggles there. So he's an atheist. He's rubbing shoulders with some people like Tolkien, who was not an atheist, and some other people as well. Some different things were happening that I won't at least try to go into right now that they were challenging some of his atheistic beliefs. And in March, between March and June 1930, he comes to be a theist. He believes in God. He believes in a personal God. This is not Christian conversion, but it is a move from atheism to theism. And here's a quotation. "Jack's conversion to Christianity occurred over a period of several years." This encourages me in evangelism. You know, you just kind of want immediately to see somebody bend the knee and profess the name of Christ. And that's marvelous when that transpires. But lots of times what happens is seeds are planted and it takes some watering and some watering and some sun and some more watering and some more seeds and who knows. And this is going on in his life. So it was a period of several years from 26, the year Dimer, which is a book of poetry that he had published, when he began to believe in this nebulous power outside of himself. And this process lasted to 31 when he became a believer in Christ. As his brother Warren wrote, his conversion, quote, "was no sudden plunge into a new life, but rather a slow, steady convalescence from a deep-seated spiritual illness of long standing." And around October 1930, Lewis begins to attend college chapel at 8 o'clock. And in September 19, 1931, he hosts Tolkien, which he had done a good bit, and another friend of his, Hugo Dyson, for a meal. And Lewis, oftentimes with these friends, it was like drinking. Lewis was not a drunk. He got drunk, I think, one time in his life when he was a teenager, but he was an alcoholic on friendship. He just relationships with people. It was like he couldn't stop. Once you got started, it was so sweet. He would just kind of keep going. And so there's lots of times where the people would come and they'd get together and it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning and they'd be going at it. or 3 o'clock in the morning. It was just ongoing. And so these guys got together, they discussed Christianity deep in the morning, and it was very, very influential in leading Lewis to become a Christian. He comes to believe in Jesus as the Son of God on September the 28th, 1931, again, largely through the influence of Tolkien. He writes, Arthur Greaves, his friend, I've just passed on from believing in God to definitely believing in Christ, in Christianity. I will try to explain this another time. My long night talk, and walk too, by the way, with Dyson and Tolkien had a good deal to do with it. He joins the Church of England, takes Holy Communion for the first time since his childhood on Christmas Day in 1931. One of the things about Lewis is that he had these meetings with these literary friends, and it was by invitation only. They're called, what are they called? They're called Inklings, the Inklings. There had been another group called Inklings, and it had ceased to exist, and he picked up that name. He was the leader of the group. They would meet at a restaurant pub called the Eagle and Child. They called it the Bird and the Baby, and this lasted for years and years. And I mean, right up to when he died, although they had to change restaurants somewhere along the way. There were about 19 different people. They would come and go. There wasn't always attendance. You know, sometimes it was slight, sometimes more folks. And they would say, all right, who's got something to read? And a lot of times somebody would have read something, and they had written something, and they'd come in and read it, and they would critique it and talk about it and chew on it. And in one letter that Lewis wrote, or let me recommend his letters. I don't have this in the bibliography, but reading Lewis's letters, there's a whole bunch more letters than what are normally published, but the collection that I got was just delightful reading, delightful. So Lewis wrote in one of those letters, is any pleasure on earth as great as a circle of Christian friends by a good fire? By a good fire. I love that. His book sales were enormous. A lot of biographies are just kind of built around when he published this book and when he published that book, and I have avoided that in this sketch. But he wrote lots, and they kind of went crazy. I was talking with Morgan, a 17-year-old assistant here earlier. She's reading the Screwtape letters now. Lewis's writings have not gotten old. He thought, he had conversation with Walter Hooper that we'll talk about here in a little bit, And Lewis said, I know what happens with literature. What happens with literature is the author dies, and you know, they publish them for a little bit and talk about them a little bit, and then everybody forgets them. That's just kind of what happens. The book winds up sitting on a shelf. And Hooper said, that's not going to be what happens with you. And he said, you just don't know what you're talking about, Walter Hooper. And Walter Hooper kind of cheated because he wound up being the guy that was in charge of his estate and his literary stuff, and he promoted it. But it helped, but I don't think he needed the help. It's just crazy. His books just published and continue. People read them all over the place. He became internationally famous. He wrote by hand, by the way, never learned how to type, never learned how to drive a car either, by the way. I think he tried on occasion, but that didn't work well. Other people chauffeured him. He possessed not only a keen mind, but the ability to see into issues and then to explain them. To say that he had incredible word skills is a gross understatement. My favorite statement of his is, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. His philosophy of writing led him to make his books understandable to non-scholars. Any fool can write learned language, he said. The vernacular, the regular old speech, that's the real test. If you can't turn your faith into it, then either you don't understand it or you don't believe it. You ought to be able to make it understandable. You know, simple for people to take in. He made piles of money off these books, of course, and he gave piles of it away, about two-thirds of it. He had financial issues. Originally, he started giving it so much away and wasn't mindful that there were taxes that he was going to have to pay, and it got him into some financial trouble. But he loved giving money away. He maintained his Oxford tutorial fellowship until December of 54, and then he's going to move to Cambridge. We'll see that in a minute, a full professorship. He gives several BBC talks in the early 40s, and those are turned into Mere Christianity, which is the top of my list in terms of reading of Lewis. I came across this, and I was really I feel like this kind of speaks to us in our day. A strategy that he had for reaching the world. C.S. Lewis was evangelistic. We think of him as being apologetics, and he was into apologetics for sure. But, you know, England's ahead of America, and I think he was dealing with stuff in England then that we're kind of dealing with now. And so this quotation that I've got here toward the bottom of page 5, or toward the middle, it's helpful. The difficulty, here's what he said, the difficulty we are up against is this. He's talking about how to evangelize. We can often make people pay attention to the Christian point of view for half an hour or so. with what we've written. But the moment they've gone away from the lecture or laid down our article, they are plunged back into a world where the opposite position is taken for granted. Every newspaper, film, novel, and textbook undermines our work, our Christian work. As long as that situation exists, widespread success is simply impossible. We must attack the enemy's line of communication. What we want is not more little books about Christianity, but more little books by Christians on other subjects with their Christianity latent. And so he writes some stuff, I think of his sci-fi stuff, that is just stories, just kind of, he's telling these cool stories, but embedded there underneath. Sometimes through literature that he received, letters that he received, they didn't understand, but embedded therein it were these Christian principles where he was trying to work and get people to think and understand things. And I wonder if that's not to some extent where we are. Again, becomes famous. The cover of Time magazine, 1947, his picture's there. His relationship with his brother was always tight, but his brother did have severe drinking problems. He's called alcoholic regularly, and Warren was a deceptive drinker, like many alcoholics, was able to appear sober even when he was not. Lewis publishes The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, October of 1950. Tolkien, by the way, never liked it, and because of that, Lewis thought about maybe never presenting it for publication. Thankfully, he did. Mrs. Moore dies in January 12, 1951, and that leaves Jack and Warney living together. And it was relief, to be honest with you, and I think Lewis pretty much just kind of said that. It was hard, you know, I mean, it was hard living with her. So he continued to have this relationship with her, but no doubt platonic after the conversion. I'm not sure where to insert this, but I just had to insert it. So Walter Hooper had become a fan of C.S. Lewis, and in 1953, he was introduced to Bob Jones Jr. This is the Bob Jones University. This is Bob, not Bob Jones Sr., but Bob Jones Jr., who had visited C.S. Lewis shortly after World War II. And so when meeting Bob Jones Jr., Walter Hooper popped a mint in his mouth to hide the smell of tobacco, and then he asked the evangelist what he thought of C.S. Lewis. And Bob Jones Jr. said, "That man smokes a pipe, and that man drinks liquor, but I do believe he is a Christian." And I'm not trying to defend his smoking or his drinking in that. But again, he accepts a Cambridge professorship in June of 1954. He carries on correspondence with this lady named Joy Davidman. If you read Surprised by Joy, there's some special stuff going on there in the title, I think. She's an American writer whose marriage was failing. Her divorce is finalized in 54. The next year she moves to close to where C.S. Lewis is. He's paying the rent and a helpful guy to her. He winds up marrying her for just helpful reasons. I won't go into the details, but she was not going to be able to continue to live there, and so they got married and that helped. But he winds up falling in love with her. George Sayer, one of his biographers, wrote of her Davidman's possessiveness, jealousy of Jack's friends, lack of emotional self-control. But Jack loved her. She had cancer that was discovered in her leg and breast in October of 56, and she dies in 1960. He writes A Grief Observed. It's worth reading. It's difficult reading. It's just the soul in anguish. He published it anonymously, and so people read that, and then some people came back and said, "You ought to read this book called A Grief Observed, because I know you're struggling." Walter Hooper, an American English professor, comes to Oxford in early 63. Again, he's a fan of Lewis. Interesting stories that Hooper, you can listen to talks. Hooper has got lots of YouTube video things where different people interviewed him. He died of COVID, I think, in maybe December of this last year, Hooper did. But anyway, you ought to watch some of the interviews with him. They're really fascinating. And Lewis just kind of took him in, introduced him to his friends, and he signs on as Lewis's personal secretary to help him, and then after Lewis dies, he's the one responsible for his putting together a whole lot of Lewis's stuff. In September of 63, just 2 months before he died, C.S. Lewis wrote to a Miss Jane Douglas, "Yes," he said, "autumn is really the best of the seasons, and I'm not sure that old age isn't the best part of life. But of course, like autumn, it doesn't last." And then he died. had heart trouble and kidney trouble. He died November 22, 1963, within the hour of when President John F. Kennedy died. Within the hour. And if it had been some time other than that, no doubt the papers would have been filled. They were in the newspapers, but obviously Kennedy's assassination was the big news. So it was some kind of an interesting life. So the bibliography that I have listed there lists some books. And so Alistair McGrath's a great theologian at Oxford, and I recommend his writings in terms of theology, but he also has dabbled in biography, and this is really good. He's a sharp guy, and you would enjoy reading that. This is by Walter Hooper and another friend of Lewis's, Roger Lancelin Green, C.S. Lewis, a biography. And it's quite insightful as well, and you'll get lots of quips. It's just, you know, this guy just did a whole lot. This is the George Sayer bio that I have alluded to, Jack, C.S. Lewis and His Times. Very insightful with lots of anecdotes as well. And then one other book I actually meant to cite from it, and I failed to do it, is this is by Lewis himself. I think we have a train, maybe. So, you can hear me? This is Surprised by Joy by Lewis. And some of this stuff that you read by Lewis, and this is the case here, it's kind of a narration of the books that he read and what they did to him. Kind of where he's thought, where they kind of had ideas, and then he'd read a book and he'd go, no, that idea's not a good idea. I can see that now. And he'd move to another book, and, well, that idea's not a good idea. Well, this is a good idea. And so some of that, at least for me, because I've not read a lot of the stuff that he read, is kind of heavy slogging, kind of tough going through it. But in this, though, there's lots of personal stuff and insightful things. It is good reading. And he tells, especially, he spends several pages talking about his conversion and kind of how that came about. And it's quite moving. I mean, he talks about being the most reluctant convert in all of, I think, England, he said. He kind of went into Christianity kicking and screaming. He didn't want to have his life interfered with. He had plans. He said, I knew if there's a God, there'll be a grand interferer. I thought of what, Diane, you told me about Jordan Peterson, if you know who Jordan Peterson is. He's not a Christian, but he's wrestling with some of Christian ideas. And I heard a little snippet of him the other day to where he said something like, I don't want to say that I believe in God. Because when you say that I believe in God, there's a whole lot of responsibility that goes along with saying I believe in God. It was convicting to hear him say that. And Lewis, you know, when you say you believe in God, if you really believe in God, there's a whole lot that goes along with that. And so he was reluctant. He was like, no. I've often thought of atheists and people who aren't Christians. They're not neutral weighing the evidence. We're fallen beings, and we recognize if I embrace God as God and His rights, that's going to put me in my place. And you get a lot of that here. Thank you so much for coming. God bless you.